Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, hello from London, England. Yes, like a pendulum do. And before we go any further in this broadcast, which is a very special broadcast, aside from coming from a totally different time zone, what better source for a jingle-praising AI could there be than AI?
AI's great, just first rate, love or hate, it's the gold state. AI is fine, like a well-edged wine, more like rhyme than turpentine.
Well, artificial intelligence, touted for its potential to transform medicine, has led to some doctors losing skills after just a few months. That's the result of a new study. AI helped health professionals to better detect precancerous growths in the colon. Ow! But when the assistance was removed, their ability to find tumors dropped by about 20% compared with rates before the tool was ever introduced. That's according to findings published this week, reported by Bloomberg. Healthcare systems around the world are embracing AI, artificial intelligence, as you know, with a view towards boosting patient outcomes and productivity. Just this year, the UK government, right here in London, announced £11 million, that's $14 million American, in funding for a new trial to test how AI can help catch breast cancer earlier. But the AI in the study probably prompted doctors to become over-reliant on its recommendations, quote, leading to technicians becoming less motivated, less focused, and less responsive when making cognitive decisions without AI assistance. That's what the scientists said in the paper. I think it was less responsive that said it. They surveyed 4 endoscopy centers in Poland. That's what I would have thought of. And compared detection success rates 3 months before AI implementation and 3 months after. Some colonoscopies were performed with AI, some without, at random. Results published in the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology Journal. I read it for the ads. A researcher at the University of Oslo, one of the scientists involved, predicted the effects of de-skilling will probably be higher as AI becomes more powerful. Can't wait for that. What's more, the 19 doctors in the study were highly experienced, having performed more than 2,000 colonoscopies each. They're living the great life. The effect on trainees or novices might be starker, said a consultant gastroenterologist at University College Hospital London. Quote, although AI continues to offer great promise to enhance clinical outcomes, we must also safeguard against the quiet erosion of fundamental skills required for high-quality colonoscopy. A study conducted by MIT this year raised similar concerns after finding that using OpenAI's ChatGPT to write essays led to less brain engagement and cognitive activity. But wait, there's more. The British Columbia Wildfire Service in Canada was forced to put out a statement about a surge in AI-generated wildfire images circulating on social media, warning that they can mislead people during emergencies. In recent weeks, staff at the Wildfire Service and members of the public have flagged multiple fabricated images, exaggerating or in some cases downplaying the scale and intensity of active fires. The service says such depictions can affect evacuation decisions and public safety. Oh, that. And Melbourne, Australia is our next dateline. A senior lawyer in Australia has apologized to a judge for filing submissions in a murder case that included fake quotes and non-existent case judgments generated by artificial intelligence. The blunder in the Supreme Court of Victoria is another in a litany of mishaps AI has caused in justice systems around the world, according to the AP. Defense lawyer Rishi Nathwani, who holds the prestigious legal title of King's Counsel took full responsibility for filing incorrect information and submissions in the case of a teenager charged with murder. That's all. That's according to court documents seen by the AP. Quote, "We're deeply sorry and embarrassed for what occurred," Nathwani told the justice on behalf of the defense team. But wait, there's more. The preprint's title, Self-Experimental Report, Emergence of Generative AI Interfaces in Dream States, roused the suspicion of a psychologist, Olivia Kirtley, this is according to Nature.com. When she clicked, her awareness grew. The manuscript posted last month to SciArchive, that is a site for non-peer-reviewed research in the sciences of psychology. What's that? Was only a few pages long and listed only one author, and that author's affiliation was not included. And the artificial intelligence experiment described in the text was, quote, "pretty out there," unquote, Olivia Kirtley, a Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. She flagged that preprint and similar ones to the managers of SciArchives. They removed the preprints. The Dream States manuscript used AI in its method, but didn't clearly declare how AI was used or whether it was used in other elements of the work, which means that it violated the site's terms of use. In response to questions from Nature, a message from the email address of the listed author said that AI played a limited part in the preprints generation. SciArchive is just one of many preprint servers and journals that are grappling with suspicious submissions. Some papers bear the fingerprints of paper mills. How do mills have fingerprints? We'll get to that later. Others show evidence of content written by AI systems, such as fake references, which can be a sign of AI hallucinations. I think I saw one. Such content poses a conundrum, says Nature, for preprint services. Many are nonprofit organizations devoted to making it easier for scientists to publish their work. Screening for low-quality content demands resources and can slow processing of submissions. Such screening also raises questions about which manuscripts to allow, and this influx of dodgy content has its own risks. Quote, how do you do quality assurance while keeping things relatively light touch so the system doesn't collapse on itself? Asks the Executive Committee of the Society for Improvement of the Psychological Sciences. No one, they say, wants a world where the individual reader has to figure out whether something is legitimate scholarship, unquote. The preprint services approached by Nature say relatively small proportion of their submissions bear signs of being generated by AI. The operators of the preprint server at XIV say it's roughly 2% of their submissions. But some say the situation seems to be getting worse. The moderators of Archive, or ARXIV, noticed an uptick in AI-written content soon after the launch of ChatGPT. But, quote, "we really started thinking there was a crisis sometime in the last 3 months, says the scientific director at the organization. And finally, a trio of researchers has disclosed a major prompt injection, ouch, vulnerability in Google's Gemini large language model. This allows for attacks ranging from permanent memory poisoning to unwanted video streaming, email exfiltration, even taking over the target's smart home systems to plunge them into darkness or open a powered window. All that triggered by nothing more than a simple Google Calendar invitation or email, this according to the Register. In reality, say the researchers on this project, an indirect prompt injection into a Google invitation is all you need to exploit Gemini for Workspace's agentic architecture, acts like an agent to trigger the following outcomes: toxic content generation, spamming, deleting events from a calendar, opening the windows in a victim's apartment, activating the boiler in a victim's apartment, turning the light off in a victim's apartment, video streaming a user via Zoom, exfiltrating a user's emails, geolocating the user via the browser. The attack, called Invitation Is All You Need, is a new twist on prompt injection, which sees instructions to large language models inserted in materials they're only supposed to use for reference. The vulnerability brings with it considerably more risk. Quote, our threat analysis and risk assessment reveals that 73% of the analyzed threats pose high critical risk to end users. The researchers warn. They say it emphasizes the need for the employment of immediate mitigations. We'll be getting right on that. AI is great. And what a week. And what a conclusion.
Striking a pose so gladly. Stroking the rose and hoping that clicks. Needing the job so badly. Praying that you're the one that he picks. Breaking a date to practice. Passing the hat and counting the dollars. Making yourself attractive. Setting your sights, you're getting your chance today. When they turn you away, it's a false start, baby, but it's not the end. You must believe, just a false start, honey, did you make a friend? That's what counts. Yeah. That's okay. Set the clock for seven. Cover all bases. Tasting a piece of heaven. Losing your sleep just seeing their faces. Trusting a smiling stranger. Playing for keeps and learning a lesson. Darling, stay out of danger. Catching your breath, you're getting your chance to go. When the answer is no, it's a false start, baby, but it's not the end. Not the end. Just a false start, honey, so you try again. And again, and again, you keep right on trying. Don't give up.
Direct from Air Force One, the old one, not the beautiful new one we're getting from the very special people of Qatar. This is Qatar's favorite president with another edition of Truth Social Audio, brought to you by Trump Sunglasses. Best in the world for keeping out those bad rays. I'm back from Alaska. I'm still sitting in Air Force One because even this one, old and tired as it is so beautiful. No other world leader has a plane like this. President Putin, who I just met with, asked if before our next summit meeting he could ride in Air Force One. I told him that such privileges are only given to friends of the United States, and he certainly seems to be one. At least he's very friendly with me, said all the right things, treated me with so much respect that, like, you couldn't believe, even said he liked my book. I said, which one? I've written so many. He said, all of them. That's the kind of person you can make a deal with. And we did. We made a very good deal. Although the morons and the losers and the fake media are so rigged against me, they won't even tell you that we did make a good deal. And I'd be the first one to tell you it wasn't a great deal. But sometimes a good deal is better than a great deal when there's going to be, like, more meetings. Maybe even with Zelensky, if he can behave himself this time. Vladimir and I agreed that this whole war wouldn't have started if I had been in office instead of Sleepy Joe. If I'd been in office and the election hadn't been rigged, then we could have agreed on a ceasefire in this terrible war that wouldn't even have happened. Now, with all the death and the thing, it's not so easy. And Vladimir and I agreed on that. And on so much more. Favorite food. Favorite movies. It was like an international loving, except with real leaders. We agreed on the Russia hoax. We agreed that the Democrats hate our country. We also agreed on the need to meet again and talk about a real peace settlement and not the fake ceasefire that would be so rigged, rigged like no one has ever seen. So the fighting and the horrible deaths will go on a little bit longer. But next time Vladimir and I meet, and it will be soon, he'll be arriving in Air Force One. Thank you for your attention to this matter. And Epstein who?
Truth Social Audio is also brought to you by Trump Extra Long Socks. More feet for your feet. So long.
With my friends, it's like I'm wasting your honor. And you know that I'd swing with you for the fences, sit with you in the trenches, give you my wild, give you a child, give you the silence that only comes when two people understand each other. Family that I chose, now that I see your brother as my brother. Is it enough? But there's robbers to the east, clowns to the west. I'd give you my sunshine, give you my best, but the rain is always gonna come if you're standing with me. I'm a fire and I'll keep your brittle heart warm. If you cascade, ocean wave blues come. All these people think love's for show, but I would die for your secret. The devil's in the details, but you got a friend in me. Would it be enough if I could never give you peace? Would it be enough if I could never give you peace? Would it be enough if I could never give you peace?
And now, the side effects of the week.
Don't use Otezla if you're allergic to it. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Severe diarrhea, nausea, or vomiting, depression, suicidal thoughts, or weight loss can happen. Tell your doctor if any of these occur and if you have a history of depression or suicidal thoughts.
This is the show. Ladies and gentlemen, there's been some discussion, maybe too much, on this program about a certain Mr. Elon Musk. There's going to be more today. I had concluded through my own experience that the Tesla Model S, as I knew it, was a pretty darn good car, and that Tesla was a pretty darn bad company. And that was personal opinion. That background, I guess, motivated me to pick up a book recently called Ludicrous by my guest today on the program, Edward Niedermeyer. Mr. Niedermeyer, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. So I enjoyed the book in that odd way. And first of all, I guess you should explain why it's called Ludicrous.
So Ludicrous is a mode on Teslas. One of the interesting things about the Model S and about Tesla is that they upgrade their cars all the time, right? And so one of the big upgrades early on was an insane mode. And then, of course, the next was Ludicrous mode, and eventually became Plaid mode. But really, you know, the story is about this attempt to start a new car company, which is really something that hasn't been seriously done for 100 years. And, you know, I think for me, the story was a lot about sort of misunderstanding the business from the get-go, which is something we see tech guys do a lot when they come into new businesses, and sort of things going off the rails. And so this book came out in 2019. A lot of the real going off the rails has happened since the book came out. Mm-hmm. But I think that my hope is at least that folks who read the book now can get some sort of perspective on this experience with Tesla that really, I think, in a lot of ways shaped the Elon Musk that we see today.
When you say that there was a misalignment between him and the automobile manufacturing business, some of it seems to have been that he thought that anything he imagined could sort of almost magically occur without understanding all of what's involved in actual automobile manufacturing. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up on the West Coast, and I feel a little bit more aligned to the world of or close to the world of sort of startups and high tech, which has very kind of West Coast culture to it, mm-hmm. in that it's really about getting super talented people together, creative solutions, you know, sort of all night, drink a bunch of Red Bull, hackathons, and coming up with, you know, creative things and doing things that no one's ever done before, and experimenting and failing and learning, you know, all these sorts of things. And, you know, essentially what Tesla has done in a lot of ways is bring that approach to the car industry. And so, you know, people see that, and there's been so much excitement around that because, you know, things like the iPhone have happened in our lifetime, where that kind of creative problem-solving innovation has created totally new things. Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, is that I sort of had ended up in covering the auto industry by accident and started during the 2008 downturn, when all of these 100-year-old companies were sort of crashing down around us.
Yeah.
And what I learned from that experience is, you know, how different the auto industry really is, in the sense that, you know, the auto industry is really a measure twice, cut once sort of thing. It's not about how fast you go. It's about sort of coordinating these global supply chains so that everything is sort of moving the same speed. So it's much more important that things are steady and consistent and predictable than they are as fast as possible, or even maybe as good as possible in some cases. Hmm. It's this massive management challenge. And now we see car companies are run by committee, but also by culture. You know, the most successful is Toyota. And it's because this scale is so immense, and because every last detail has to be so perfect is the other thing. And so between the testing and validation that happens, and then the manufacturing that happens, all of these things align around, you know, sort of slow, steady, leave a little bit of innovation on the table in order to have things really be proven and validated. And so when Tesla came in, you know, they made this big splash because they couldn't have had a more different approach. And because it all happened in the shadow of the iPhone, it seemed like this is the future. I think what we're learning now is that, you know, yes, that innovative culture was a fresh wind that needed to blow through the auto industry, for sure. It was something that was necessary. but it wasn't going to just replace what came before because it simply isn't capable of managing the scale and complexity and the quality level, frankly, that the auto industry requires.
Well, the difference between the iPhone and the car is that one of them can kill people.
That's absolutely right. And one of the examples in the book is the giant screen on the Model S and the Model X. You mm-hmm. know, it was the biggest screen in 2012 in any car. And to this day, it's still one of the biggest screens you can get in a car. And, you know, people look at that and they assume, well, Tesla's a Silicon Valley company. They have a bigger screen than anyone else. Their technology must be better. What they did to make that happen was they simply put it in the screen that wasn't to automotive grade standards. And so for years, no one else would compete with them because no one else would put a screen that wasn't up to this automotive grade, which is a series of very, very, it's sort of the highest grade of consumer facing quality testing. And it's like, you know, they take it up to 40 degrees Celsius, negative 40 degrees Celsius, and cycle back and forth. And it has to be robust to these things. And you still can't make a screen that size. But people don't understand this. People don't keep their cars long enough. And so, you know, we're still catching up, I think, to sort of the long tail of like why Tesla's approach doesn't really work for something that's supposed to be as durable and robust as a car.
There are 2 years that you recount in the book that I think stand out as signals of Musk's approach to running a company. And one of them is 2013. Tell me a little about what happened then.
So the Roadster had been their first car and had been this massive learning experience. It had to raise all this money and it was never going to make money. And so they had to get the Model S out. They got a government loan to do it. They basically got a free factory to do it. They had all these things line up that otherwise they would not have been able to do it.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. A federal government loan.
A federal government loan, $500 million almost. And what was interesting about this is that they start production on the Model S. They started around mid-2012. And for the second half of 2012, even though they got the Motor Trend Car of the Year, which was a huge deal for them. And mm-hmm. they were starting to really get like media attention, mm-hmm. but they weren't converting their pre-orders to sales. There's a number of sort of explanations for why that wasn't happening. And by the time the beginning of 2013 came around, they were in deep trouble. And by the way, Tesla's been in financial trouble, you know, on a regular basis throughout its history. But this was another crisis moment. And by the end of the first quarter of 2013, they were going to be completely out of cash. Well, they were reporting their sales to the government on a monthly basis, which is a level of detail that they normally didn't report at the time. And it turned out they turned their sales around in the last month of that quarter. But turning around your entire quarters of sales in the last month of the quarter is not something that normally happens. And if they hadn't turned the sales around and been able to engineer as profit, they were going to have to sell the company to Google. They had a deal on the table, a handshake deal with Google. And they ended up turning around the sales miraculously. Again, there's rumors that they sold some cars to themselves. It's hard to prove exactly how they did it, but the timing is deeply suspicious. So they went to the financial markets and they said, look, we turned this profit. We've proven that we can be profitable, even though it was a minuscule and highly engineered profit. They borrowed money and they used it to pay off their government loans. And at that moment, you know, I was still covering the auto bailout and, you know, GM and Chrysler were saying they paid off the loans, but they weren't really. And then after that first quarter of 2013, which I call the immaculate quarter, you know, he went on this media blitz where it was like he wanted to be in the news every week. And you know, 2013 was a long time ago, but this was the start of the Elon Musk that we sort of know today, where he is out there every day promising something new, you know, and putting on a show and getting that attention.
I do think that the one really great idea he had or has had, I mean, it is now almost well known that he didn't start Tesla, he bought it, right?
Yep.
Briefly, what were the circumstances of that?
He wanted to buy an electric sports car for himself. And he'd gone to the shop in Los Angeles called AC Propulsion. And this was like a shop by veterans of the General Motors EV1 program, which had been kind of a skunk works. And those guys had a shop and they were doing, you know, modifications. And this was like, they were some of the first in the LA area or anywhere in the world to be selling modified, you know, taking regular cars and turning them into EVs. He had at the same time that he had asked them to sort of buy or then commercialize this sort of prototype that they built. Someone else, a guy called Martin Eberhardt, had paid them to make a lithium ion version of this sports car that they sort of made. And basically what AC Propulsion said was, we want to make a little it was a Scion XB. I don't know if you remember this little boxy, you know, sort of city car. And they said, that's the car we want to modify. Tom Hanks bought one. A few other folks bought them. They weren't that big. But he said, you two guys, you know, Martin Eberhard and Elon Musk. Elon Musk has money. Martin Eberhard is a proven founder. And he had e-readers in his last company. So he had sort of a hardware background. He said, you two get together and do it. And Martin Eberhard had already started the business when they linked up. And so Elon Musk came in and funded what you call the Series A, the first sort of round of funding. And then essentially became the money guy for the company. And Martin Eberhard ran it until Elon essentially forced him out.
What I was going to say is he to me had one great idea, which is he was not going to spend a dollar on advertising. He was going to be the advertising. And when you talk about the person he's become, I think to a large extent intended that to be true, because he was a walking ad for the cars.
That's right. So for the book I'm working on right now, I've been really kind of revisiting his whole biography, because I think now with sort of, you know, this book, the book we're discussing, Ludacris, came out in 2019. And at that time, it was still sort of ambiguous who he was really, right? Like compared to now.
Yeah.
And so I've been kind of going back and revisiting his biography, you know, and a lot of it, the official versions of his biography are really unsatisfying, because they all sort of start with the assumption that he's a technology genius. The narrative that explains his technological chops or whatever are what explains him as a person and him as a figure. And so, you know, like the key biographical detail often is that he made a video game when he was 12 years old or whatever. And the reality is that, like, that's not the source of his power, right? That's not really the strengths that he's built his empire on. Really, he's a storyteller. He's a marketer. As you say, his real insight is that he was ahead of the curve in the sort of world we now live in, where everyone is an influencer to some extent and everyone is building a personal brand online all the time. And so much wealth and power can accrue from simply getting people's attention. So I've been asking myself, where does that come from with this guy? And the answer came to me, I think, or at least part of the answer came to me from an interview with his father that I found very illuminating. His father is South African. And obviously Elon Musk grew up in South Africa. You know, Elon and his mother both left South Africa in 89. It was after the fall of P.W. Botha, who was the last sort of like fully pro-apartheid prime minister. And F.W. de Klerk had just come in, but apartheid wasn't yet over.
Right.
And by the way, P.W. Botha was a family friend of the Musks. He stayed with them at their home. Right. And so for a young Elon Musk in the 80s and 90s, you know, in the shadow of the boycott and divestment movement against South Africa was huge at this time. Because apartheid had still not fallen. It was starting to get results, but it hadn't actually brought down apartheid yet. As a young man, Elon's father said, you know, Elon had to position himself a certain way when he came to America. It's that thing of, if you don't tell your story, someone else will. And the idea was that if he didn't talk the right talk, people would just assume he was just another racist South African. For me, this is sort of the genesis of Elon's sort of getting ahead of the game in the attention economy, is that he was having to brand himself, who he is, where he comes from, craft a narrative, a personal narrative, the way anybody starting a career today kind of has to. You know, he was doing that in the late 80s and early 90s, literally decades before the social media revolution that has now made that sort of stock and trade for both him and again, almost everybody in any kind of public role.
The other year that has stood out to me in your report was 2018. Tell me a little about that.
At the time, you know, my book came out in 2019. I was in the thick of writing this book that really covered a lot of history. And so I wasn't sort of, I don't think, seeing exactly like where this was going to go. Like, as critical as I was of Elon, I did not think it was going to get as bad as it has gotten. But there was a critical turning point there. By 2018, you know, so the Model 3 had come out. So this was sort of the biggest leap in Tesla's history in terms of going from tiny volume in the Roadster, sort of small in the Model S and the Model X, and then huge, much bigger volume with the Model 3 and then the Model Y. But they were having real struggle building them because, again, the culture was not aligned around building lots of cars at high volume with really good quality. And he was under an immense amount of stress. Tesla was once again on the brink of bankruptcy. But you know, at the same time, the valuation was high. It was a publicly traded company. It had just so much more attention. And then there were clearly things also happening in his personal life. you know, this was sort of the end point of what we call production hell, which is about a year from 2017 until about the summer, so fall of 2018, that Model 3 was that they were really struggling to build them at the quality they needed or at the price point that they needed. They were selling them, I think, basically at a loss, as far as we could tell, for a lot of that time. He started to get a little crazy. And one of the first thing was calling the Thai cave rescue gentleman a pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have to get involved in that situation,
right?
The Thai rescue thing was happening. He chose to say, I'm going to come in, I'm going to be the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he wasn't able to be the hero, when his solution wasn't a good one, you know, the guy who was sort of more deeply involved said, like, hey, you know, we didn't really need you. Like, you know, I think he said he could stick his submarine where the sun doesn't shine or something like that. And Elon was deeply wounded. So the narcissism was really coming out. And then when he called him a pedophile, it was the turning point for his fan base as well. Because, you know, the internet can have this really radicalizing effect on people. And he built this machine that wasn't just individuals. It wasn't just influencers. It was whole media outlets, you know, that were sprouting up just to cover Tesla and just to promote the stock, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a, you know, a really critical point in this sort of developing cult where it was like, you can't criticize Elon for calling someone a pedophile, you know? And up to that point, it's like, okay, if it had been about, you know, almost anything else, there could be some discussion or some debate, but this was like this tipping point. And the fact that, you know, he eventually got away with it at trial, in part because Vern Unsworth hired Lynn Wood, who would go on to be one of Donald Trump's crazy lawyers, and wasn't able to hold Elon Musk accountable. And I think that was a really key moment in Elon and his fans sort of saying, you know, this is it. Like, there are no more boundaries left. There's nothing left. Nothing that Elon can do that will ever cause meaningful consequences. And then hard on the heels of that, you know, just within a month was the funding secured incident where Elon Musk, you know, allegedly, according to one witness, you know, under the influence of drugs, I haven't been able to verify that. But regardless, he straight up, you know, tweeted that the Saudis were going to buy Tesla, right? They were going to take it from a publicly traded company to a private company, and they were going to do it at you know, $420 a share, which was clearly a drug reference. And again, coming on the heels of this pedophile thing, it was just another sign that, like, this guy was just sort of leaving the bonds of gravity behind, right? That he was escape velocity, essentially.
Well, that was where the SEC got after him, right? Securities Exchange Commission.
It was, but there too, right? They fined him $20 million. They fined Tesla $20 million, which was nothing. It happens all the time where especially with Elon, where he does something bad and he gets fined too little. And that's a big part of this problem, is that he then, right, it just becomes a calculation. But then the SEC thing went a step further, where they said, in addition to the money, that he needed a Twitter sitter, someone to actually make sure, like, valid, you know, sign off on his tweets to make sure he's not just lying to people. And that was something that they ended up being totally unable to enforce. And Elon got to sort of openly defy, like, a very important federal regulator, and no one was able to sort of rein him in from there. This was the point, you know, when the Biden administration came in, then there was definitely an effort to move towards prosecutions for fraud, recalls, and maybe even potentially stop sales on autopilot and full self-driving were certainly in the works, and they were certainly possible. Unfortunately, they were not able to seal the deal within 4 years. And of course, because Elon bought the election for Donald Trump, for the moment, those consequences have, you know, retreated even further into the future.
The book is full of incidents where Musk promises something and puts a timetable on it, and either the thing never eventuates or the timetable is wildly optimistic.
This goes way back. You know, I mean, funding secured, that was in 2018. That was a, you know, lot of news coverage. A lot of people knew what was going on there. I didn't realize until I went back into the history that he'd done the same thing in 2008 and 2009. He'd in late 2008, he announced a funding round that was literally saving Tesla from bankruptcy. It was at least a month and a half before they actually closed the deal. So he was pre-announcing deals that weren't done, you know, 10 years before sort of the big scandal around that. And then just months after that, he pre-announced a government loan. Right. The government loan in 2009, he sent out an email to the Roadster deposit holders, people who put down money towards a Roadster. And he said, we have been approved for the loan and it will be dispersed soon. That was what his email said. Well, I went and FOIA'd their applications, you know, did a Freedom of Information Act request for their record.
Right.
They hadn't even done a full application for the loan at that time. But again, the government didn't do anything. And people forget, you know, people associate Elon Musk with Donald Trump so much. But what you have to remember is that Obama was really kind of in a lot of ways the guy who created Elon, because, you know, Elon had something really promising for Obama, which was you want to have an EV policy. You want to have a climate policy. Well, OK, subsidize our cars, right? Put $7,500 on the hood of our cars, help us sell cars, and then we will make cheaper and cheaper and cheaper cars. And the government doesn't have to get involved, doesn't have to do a lot of big, you know, investments and complicated policy and all these sorts of things. You can keep it very simple. And like, we as the private sector will just take care of this for you. Now, for Obama, that was great, right? Because he can claim to be helping the environment without, you know, having to take a lot of stuff into Congress and fighting the Republicans on it. And Elon was very convenient. And so that's why the Obama administration didn't say like, hey, man, you can't just say that you're getting a loan when you haven't even done a full application yet.
The case of the Model X, going back to 2018, was almost a paradigm of his inability to deliver on time and what he had promised. Its companion phenomenon still going on to this day is a little thing called full self-driving.
That's right. Yeah, so this is the topic that I'm focused on right now. I'm working on a new book that is about autopilot and full self-driving. You know, throughout the history, what I think the reason it's valuable to still read Ludacris today, even though again it came out in 2019, is that it illustrates sort of the original sins that kind of got Tesla behind the eight ball and had to sort of keep making up new promises in order to sort of fund the last thing that they promised. And you see this a lot in Silicon Valley startups, right? And if you have a software business, the profits, when you have a really, truly profitable software business, the profits are so huge, that's okay. You can pay off multiple rounds of funding if you get to that maturity because the profit margins are so good. The problem is that in the car business, you know, you're not just making some software and then, right, with software, the scale is just, you know, control C, control V, right? Copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste. There's no scaling cost to it. But with cars, that's not the case. Each car that you build is still hard. There's efficiencies of scale, but there's also complexity that comes with scale and managing the supply chain and all of that. So there've been a series of these various promises. You know, I mentioned the supercharging. They said that, you know, all the superchargers are going to be solar powered and free. You know, there was the battery swap. Every car is going to be able to drive into the swap station and swap out the battery faster than filling with gas. You know, that was never more than an illusion that was frankly being used to sort of scam the California's EV credit system. There's been a number of these, but they were all sort of like complex and arcane and not well understood and not big national stories. But they kept kind of getting them out of the trouble that they would fall into every 9 to 18 months, call it. Full self-driving is where this hit escape velocity, because all of a sudden it was their most successful sort of, you know, pump, so to speak, right? And it happened right when, you know, the Model S was out. The Model X just sort of come out, but it was, as you say, delayed, right? And they were finally getting it out. And then they were showing the Model 3, but that would be some time before that was available. And meanwhile, the Model S was getting old and the Model X had quality problems. Demand was weak again. And you know, autopilot was the start of Tesla sort of selling the idea that, like, look at what the vehicle is doing. Doesn't it look like it's driving itself? Doesn't it look like it's almost there? And people saying, yeah, it's steering, it's braking, it's accelerating. It must be either driving itself or almost good enough to drive itself. And, you know, that was the point at which, you know, Elon said, okay, so we have this new hardware version. And by the way, this was also right around the same time in 2016 was when people started to die using autopilot. But, you know, with autopilot, there was some ambiguity about what was going on. It was, they would say on the one hand, it was a driver assistance system. On the other hand, it was, you know, it was close to self-driving, but it wasn't. You have to pay attention all the time. And there was a lot of stuff going on there that people didn't understand. But with full self-driving, it was like the thing. So this fall, so in October, it'll be 9 years that Tesla's been saying one of these days we're going to send a software update to your car and it's just going to drive itself. And it still never happened. And I think one of the big mysteries about this, you know, I think there's the book I'm working on, it's certainly partly about the technology. And I think people need to learn and understand what's going on with this technology clearly, because they're so easily, you know, fooled by this stuff. But it's also, you know, what's happening in our heads. And really what it comes down to is that people want to believe this is true. There are other companies that do self-driving technology, but Tesla is the only company that's saying the car that you buy and own will drive itself anywhere that you want to go. And no one else is doing it. And it's because it is technologically implausible. The short explanation for this is that to make a car drive, you essentially have to make driving as much like one of the board games that AI can beat humans at as possible. Okay, so, you know, Go or chess are very complex games, and AI beats us handily now at both of them, right? So how do you make driving like those games? There's two things that you sort of fundamentally have to do. One is you constrain the board game. What you're doing is you're building a data model that allows you to navigate the world. Now, building a data model of, for example, a fishbowl is relatively easy, because in a fishbowl, you're only going to encounter so many things. Mm-hmm. Building a data model that can recognize every situation you're going to encounter in the real world in all of its complexity, from the deserts to the mountains to the jungles, you know, every weather condition, you know, every time of day, every traffic scenario, every actor, cyclist and motorcycles and scooters and pedestrians, all of it. That's really, really hard. But to be a car, you have to do that, because a car, no one buys a car that can't leave a city. You know, when you see a Waymo, those are operating driverlessly now in LA and San Francisco and Phoenix. And that's what they're doing, is they're going city to city and they're saying, we're going to build a, you know, a game essentially of driving in this area. And by limiting the area that they operate in, which by the way is fine for a taxi never has to leave town, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a car, no one's going to buy a car that can't leave town.
He has promised, I believe, that one of his self-driving cars could drive from Los Angeles to New York, right?
That's right. He is promising a general solution to self-driving. And he's the only one who's really promising that. And certainly the only one who's taking money for that. Because the other thing that you need for Waymo. So again, Waymo shows they're doing self-driving, mm-hmm. right? And they're doing it as taxis. Part of that is they limit the area that they operate in. And so if you drive enough in that area, you get your statistical likelihood mm-hmm. that you've seen everything you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
The other really critical point is that when you play a board game like chess or Go, both of the agents, right, whether it's the human or a system, an AI, they have perfect information over the board. There's no question about where the pieces are and where the spaces on the board are,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if there's some occlusion, right, or some way of blocking their vision, or they don't see the whole picture, you know, you can only make decisions based on the data that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a game where you constrain the board, you give them a perfect view of the whole game, they can understand and calculate all of the possibilities. And this is where a computer gets an advantage over a human.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in order to do that in driving, you need really expensive sensors. It's a perception problem. And so what Waymo does, in addition to constraining where they operate, is they put 25 cameras, four high-powered imaging radars, and then a whole suite of LiDAR, which is like a laser imaging mm-hmm. system. It's like a radar, only instead of shooting radio waves and bouncing them off things, it's shooting lasers off things and bouncing.
And that's the thing that Musk has said won't be on a self-driving Tesla, right? LiDAR.
That's right. And he won't tell you the real reason. The real reason is simple. It's because it's too expensive. A Waymo, we don't know what the exact price of a Waymo vehicle is, but it's probably on the order of, call it $300,000.
Mm.
So this is the fundamental problem that Tesla had. They were taking a car business that's about making and selling cars and trying to adapt it to this technology. Whereas what Waymo did was they said, what can this technology actually do? And what is the business that we can build around that? Well, what they found was, right, a taxi, it doesn't have to leave the city. And if you put all those expensive sensors on it, it's okay because it can work 24 hours a day to pay off that fixed cost.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a consumer is not going to spend $300,000 on a car that doesn't leave town.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't fit the business model. But so what's been happening for 8 years now is that Tesla's been selling something that is utterly implausible from a technological perspective when you understand how the technology works. But it perfectly fits the mental model that people have in their minds when you say self-driving car,
mm-hmm.
right? Because when I say to you as a non-expert, self-driving car, autonomous vehicles, or any of these terms, you build a mental model and you start with what you know, which is a car. Well, what is a car? A car fundamentally is something that you own. It's cheap enough that you can buy it and own it. And there's a range of that, right? But still the average cost of a car is like 40, you know, I don't know what the current is, something like $40,000, $45,000 maybe. It has to be affordable. Well, the LiDAR and the radar and all those sensors, that makes that way off in the distance. But then the real challenge is that having a statistical level of certainty that your system is safe, you only get that if you constrain where it goes. And so a car, people buy a car fundamentally to go 1 mile or 1,000 miles, right? Mm-hmm. It's literally anywhere you want to go.
Right.
And so Elon is playing into a fantasy that has been, by the way, you know, created long before him, right? General Motors used to in the 50s and 60s, they used to show videos of your private car that you put on the freeway and it drives itself. And it's our cultural interpretation of this technology.
And if I'm not mistaken, Musk has said to people, to people to whom he wants to sell these cars to, well, you know, you don't use your car all the time. When it's parked, you can rent it out to other people.
That's right.
It's like saying, right. Well, you only sleep in your bed 8 hours a day. The other 16, you can have somebody come in and sleep on your bed and charge them.
Yeah. I mean, this is his creative way of making this technology fit into the private car model.
Hmm.
So, and this is really, you know, this is the key of his success with electric vehicles as well, if you think about it, right? So prior to Tesla in the electric vehicle space, you know, there'd been this idea that, you know, EVs had to be compromises somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because the batteries were expensive. What the implication was that we have to sort of adjust to smaller batteries, right? Less range.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to change our behavior patterns in order to adopt EVs. Well, Tesla came along and said, no, don't listen to those hippies, right? What we can do is we'll just load these cars up with way more batteries than anyone had ever put in an EV before.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, they're expensive at first, but eventually the cost will come down.
And well, he had a Roadster, which was just the ultimate proof of, look, it can be fun.
Yeah, exactly. And the Model S, and actually every Tesla is very rapid by mm-hmm. the standards of gas cars,
yeah.
Which again is a way to make them appeal to traditional American motor vehicle values, mm-hmm. right? They are big cars, they're heavy cars, they are rapidly accelerating cars. These are the Americans' favorite things about cars, mm-hmm. these particular attributes. And the reality is that, you know, most people, you know, the average American drives like something like 40 miles a day. The amount of times that we go over 100 or 150 miles is like in the single digit percentage of the time. And the approach that Tesla took was critical to jump starting the EV business. Every new technology needs rich people to buy in and to want to buy them, to make it cool, to frankly overpay for them, mm-hmm. so that you can bend the cost curve for this new technology and make it more affordable to people. The problem was that Tesla got locked into this idea that you can't sell an EV without at least 250 or 300 miles of range. Also, you can't sell an EV unless it's quick, unless it's sexy, right? Unless it sort of locked itself into these brand values. We've seen a lot of other car companies now mimic that or like fight for that kind of market share, right? Where it's other cars with about 300 miles of range that are sexy looking, that are fast, that are high
mm-hmm.
tech.
Mm-hmm.
But the market is now stalling because all of those things, in order to make an electric car feel comparable to a gas car, you have to put a lot of battery and a lot of power into it. And what you trade off is affordability. Now, this is all happening at a time where cars are getting more expensive anyway. And so that's kind of concealing some of this dynamic. But right now, the US EV market is stalled out because the cost can't come down low enough. And so, you know, to some extent, Tesla kickstarted the EV adoption era, but they've also held it back because what I think we need to do to really get to a point where everyone can afford an EV and where this is something sustainable, what we need to leave behind is the era of one car that does it all.
Right. So you're saying a city car and then a road car.
Exactly. Right. Which is, by the way, the early days of the car business, that's what it was. You had city cars and you had touring cars.
Yeah.
Frankly, every American could could do 90% of their regular driving with 150 miles of range. So autonomous vehicle technology is moving towards more general capability. But like all robots, you automate for a task. You only know that a robot is doing its job because you know what it looks like to do that job well. And you can only do that if you define the job that the robot is supposed to do. There is no such thing as general automation. It's a powerful science fiction trope. And by the way, it's one that we seem to be as humans very, very, very prone to falling into the illusion that something is more generally autonomous than it is.
Well, Elon is already saying, well, there will be 10 billion robots, right? If not more in the world in the, by 2030 or whatever date he's picked out of the hat that week. And, you know, that many autonomous vehicles and that many robots. Is he a serial promiser at this point? Can we define him as that?
He is.
Yeah. It's been great talking with you, Ed. I'm calling you Ed now. It's been been talking for long enough. The book that came out in 2019 that I still recommend is called Ludicrous. And when's your next book coming out?
About this time next year.
Oh, great. And what'll be? Yep. Do you know what the title will be?
We are still in the final stages of finalizing the title. It may be something like The Autopilot Effect. We have a couple of other titles that we're in the last stages of finalizing that.
Cool.
But it's about autopilot and full self-driving. That's really the part of all of this that Elon has leveraged into the truly insane amount of wealth and power that we've seen in recent years.
Okay. Edward Niedermeyer, thank you for your time. Thank you for your research. Thank you for your thoughts and for being with me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
That's it for this week's little show. Back next week, same time on these radio stations or on your audio device of choice whenever you want it. The email address for this program, your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts and the playlist heard here on, and much more, all at harryshearer.com. And tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego desk, to Pam Halstead and to Thomas Walsh at WWNO New Orleans for their help. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. It originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Changes Easy Radio Network. So long from sunny London.